Hi there, I'm Bill Radke, and welcome to KUOW's The Record. We're on Twitter at KUOW. No government shutdown. But what did Washington legislators agree to? And how did they finally get there after three special sessions? That's coming up in about 5 minutes. First, the Seattle City Council held an open meeting last night to hear from the public about the police shooting of Charlena Lyles. KUOW reporter Amy Radel was there. Hi, Amy.
Hi there.
What did you hear at the packed hearing?
Yeah, it was held at Kane Hall on the UW campus with the city council members all on stage, listening to the testimony. We heard from neighbors, from activists. People had a lot of different ideas for how to prevent police shootings in the future. It really ran the gamut of emotions. And one woman even broke into song.
I said, I'm calling. I said, I'm calling on my help tonight because something needs to happen that haven't happened before.
I saw that Charlena Lyles' father was there and her grandfather, too.
Exactly. They came from out of state even to attend. And there had been a question of whether her family would be there. Some members stayed away. But her father, grandfather, and brother were in attendance. And her father said he wasn't there to talk about police. He wanted to talk about his grief, his sadness that her children are now split up into different households, and just the distress that he's been in over this.
So I just feel bad that she's gone. And my thing is, her kids are so devastated, you know, to see their mother laying there. But I'm so hurt, man. I keep on having these anxiety attacks, depression. It's just sad.
So Amy, Charlena Lyles' family was there, members of the public were there. The entire city council was there. There was some question over whether anybody from the Seattle Police Department would be there. What's going on?
They weren't. And the main reason that the NAACP and some of her family called for this hearing was they said that their goal was to question and discuss this with Seattle Police Chief Kathleen O'Toole directly. So when she said she would not be in attendance, they said for them, there was really no point in coming last night. So some of them were not there. We had kind of an amazing exchange of letters between City Council member Kashama Sawant, who said she thought that Chief O'Toole should be required to attend. And then Chief O'Toole responded very pointedly. She accused Sawant of ignorance and disdain for the investigatory process that the police department is following. So clearly a lot of tension between the council members and the police department over this shooting. And Sawant addressed this last night before the hearing.
This is not surprising, but really unfortunate. This is a completely insensitive, tone-deaf, and cavalier response.
So O'Toole says that Sawant has not participated in long-term work on police accountability?
Yeah, that would have been the opportunity for dialogue and that it's just kind of coming too suddenly now.
Okay, so no police chief at the meeting, no police there. And yet people want more information. So how is SPD dealing with that?
They've provided documents more quickly than in previous cases. We've seen very prompt release of audio, video, the schematic of Charlena Lyles' apartment even, and also the officer statements have been released at this point.
So at this meeting last night, there were calls for a third-party investigation. What are the odds that that's going to happen?
Yeah, Councilmember Sawant wants an independent, community-led investigation, is how she's described it. That would be a big departure from their usual process. It would certainly be subject to union negotiations with police officers to take a different approach like that. Councilmember Lorena Gonzalez acknowledged that there's interest among police reform advocates in trying a different approach. She said she considers herself an advocate for reform. She worked as a lawyer who sued SPD over use of force incidents before she was elected. But she said after talking to the Community Police Commission and some different people involved in this process, Councilmember Gonzalez is not sure how that model could be explored for Seattle.
Who investigates the Seattle Police Department when it's the largest law enforcement agency and the department that's usually called in by other agencies to do their investigations because of our resources and access to resources and because of the high level of training that we have in comparison to other law enforcement agencies?
So, Amy, Councilmember Gonzalez is saying SPD is too big to be investigated by someone else?
And that seems like it's only part of the issue. I mean, there have been third-party investigations of different incidents, sometimes by the Washington State Patrol or different law enforcement agencies. To have a community-led investigation would probably be the challenge. That's something that hasn't maybe been done before. But it would also totally go counter to what SPD has been trying to do in the last few years, which is build up its own civilian-led police accountability. We have the Internal Investigations Office. We're creating, Seattle has voted to create a new office of inspector general. So the city has been working to kind of increase its own capacity to analyze police practices. Now we're seeing this call for someone, you know, from the outside to come in. So that would just be a totally different tactic. And Mayor Murray put out a statement last night saying that the public should feel confident in the integrity of the city's own investigation.
Okay, that's KUOW reporter Amy Radel telling you about this packed public hearing on the University of Washington campus last night regarding the fatal shooting by Seattle police of Charlena Lyles. Amy, thanks for catching us up.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Now on KUOW's The Record, we're going to get into the government shutdown that didn't happen. Stay tuned. Partial shutdown of Washington State's government averted. After three special sessions, legislators have reached what they're calling a budget deal in principle. Joining us live, KUOW's Olympia correspondent, Austin Jenkins. Hi, Austin.
How you doing? Good to be here.
Good to have you. The governor announced a deal this morning. We still don't have details, though. What do we know about this budget?
Well, we know that I didn't stay up all night waiting for this announcement, and I'm feeling like I learned a lesson from 2 years ago. Whether the lawmakers learned a lesson, I don't know, because we're right back where we started again. They're actually a day later than they were in 2013, so they're really pushing their luck here. What we know is that they do have an agreement in principle, as you said. So that means that they've sized the box. They know how much this next budget will spend, and they know where the money will come from, which means they've got agreement on the taxes piece. And they probably still have some details to work out in terms of the specifics, but they also have to go now sell this to their respective caucuses, and that's not going to happen until tomorrow at 10 in the morning.
Why did this take three special sessions and an almost government shutdown?
You know, the conventional wisdom, I guess, is it takes this long because you've got divided government, and that's tough because they're coming at each other with very different philosophies and approaches. And to try to reconcile those two is not easy. And also, nobody wants to be the first to blink. But I also think it's important to kind of take into consideration here that in many ways for the budget negotiator, the lead budget writer in each chamber, the hardest job they have is to go back and sell their own members on the compromise that they're agreeing to. If you wait until the very end like this, I think it's easier to go back in and say, look, folks, this is the deal. Time's up. If you want to vote for it, fine. If you don't, that's your choice. We'll find the votes and we're going to get this done.
Interesting theory. So it's going to be a hard sell. Might as well make it a quick sell.
I absolutely. And I think what you'll probably see in the final analysis is that the House will lose some liberal Democrats who don't think that this does enough, doesn't raise enough taxes, doesn't spend enough perhaps in human services and in healthcare. And you're going to lose some conservative Republicans who don't like some of the details of the taxes piece of this. That's my hunch. And they said it would be a bipartisan budget. It's bipartisan in the sense that Democrats in the House and Republicans in the Senate negotiated it. I think the final vote may also be bipartisan because that's what we've seen historically.
Well, we've heard about a capital gains tax idea. We heard about a carbon tax idea. What do you think will be in the final budget?
Well, I think the wild card here is, will there be a carbon tax in this final deal? At this point, I do not have any indication there will be. But that would be a huge surprise, a last-minute moment of shock if it is in there. And it could be because it's a source of revenue that potentially pleases people on both sides of the aisle, oddly enough. There are some water infrastructure projects in Southwest Washington and Eastern Washington that a carbon tax could pay for that Republicans would like. And it's certainly a priority of Governor Inslee. But let's leave that off the table for the moment. We have no indication at this point that that is part of the final deal. I'm expecting a new statewide property tax levy as proposed by Republicans, not at the level that they had originally proposed, probably somewhere around 90 cents to a dollar. That will go to schools. We will see some lowering of local school levies, probably not elimination of local levies as Republicans propose, but some lesser percentage they're allowed to levy rate at. And then we'll probably see some extension of taxes of internet sales, out-of-state internet sales, as proposed by Democrats. We don't know if there will be changes also to the real estate excise tax. There won't be a capital gains tax, but there may be some other things they do to gain some revenue. Again, we're going to have to wait to see the details to know really what they are.
Austin, you mentioned school levies in there, and that's the big megillah here. Who's going to decide whether or not this budget satisfies this state Supreme Court mandate to fully fund basic education?
Well, that will be the Supreme Court itself. And so after this passes, the legislature will have some number of days to send a report to the court on what it's done. Both sides of the lawsuit, the plaintiffs and defendants, that being the coalition that sued and the state of Washington, will have a opportunity to weigh in with the court and explain why it does enough or why it doesn't do enough. And then the court will get to decide. My guess would be before, what month are we in? June? Before the end of the year.
Yeah, late June. Yeah, almost the end of June when we might have shut down the government in this part of the country. So what is going to happen if any of these parties don't like what the state legislature has come up with?
I think that we would not be unlikely to see the plaintiffs in this case tell the court that they don't think that this passes muster. And I'm saying that not knowing what this is, but I'm just anticipating that's not an unlikely scenario. If the court agrees, if the court says you did not complete your assignment, that this does not do enough to address whether that's taking pressure off local levies or, most importantly, fully funding schools, including paying teacher and staff salaries that are enough to recruit and retain teachers and staff over the long haul, if the court doesn't think they passed muster on that, then the court could do any number of things. It could really double down on sanctions and eliminate all tax exemptions or close public schools. I mean, that would be dramatic. Maybe not likely, but on the list of possibilities. The court could also step up its fine. Currently $100,000 a day, it could say now you're being fined $500,000 a day or $1 million a day, something that would be intended to force the legislature back into session to try to do better. And then, of course, if this satisfies the court can say, case closed. We're done retaining jurisdiction. Everybody can move on and live their lives now.
Okay, so lawmakers are expected to vote on the budget by Friday, avoiding a partial shutdown. But as you just heard, as Austin said, the hard sell turns into a hard quick sell. Austin Jenkins, our Olympia correspondent, let's watch it together. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Coming up on KUOW's The Record, why hasn't Seattle elected a woman as its mayor in almost a century? That's coming up. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. In just a couple of weeks, Seattle voters are going to narrow down a crowded field of mayoral candidates. Primary election ballots are due August 1st. 21 people are running, and this year there are 6 women on the ballot, which is notable in this town because Seattle has only elected a woman as mayor one time in its history, almost 100 years ago, 1926. And people want to know why. Why haven't Seattle voters picked a woman to run the city in 91 years? KUOW listener Nick Russo was curious, so he asked our local Wonder Project for help getting some answers.
During the time that I've been in Seattle, we've had woman governor, 2 women senators, woman congresswoman now. We don't seem shy to vote for women in leadership positions, but for some reason, to my knowledge, very few women have even run for mayor.
Nick, what if your question, why hasn't Seattle elected a woman mayor for so long, what if it's unanswerable?
Oh, I think in a way it probably is unanswerable because we can't.
Thanks a lot for asking us an unanswerable question.
I think it's an interesting exploration, whether there's really an answer or not.
Well, then let's have an interesting exploration. Thank you, Nick. We're going to give it a shot right now with Kathy Allen, co-founder of the Center for Women and Democracy at the University of Washington, longtime Seattle political consultant at her company, The Connections Group. Kathy, you've helped a lot of women get elected to things other than mayor in the Seattle area over the last couple of decades.
Sure, senators and all kinds of, I guess, 4 country presidents now that are women that I have actually been able to work with. But yeah, no mayor.
Joni Balter has covered Seattle politics for decades, a former Seattle Times editorialist, now host of Seattle Channel's Civic Cocktail. Hey, Joni.
Hey.
So let's talk about this. We called up a few women who have run for mayor and asked for their help answering this question. Why no woman mayor in Seattle for almost a century? So we're going to play some of that for you. First, I asked former Seattle City Council member Jan Drago why it even matters whether the mayor is a man or a woman.
A woman would make a better mayor. Women govern differently than men, and they're more likely to be inclusive. They're more likely to compromise. They're more likely to listen. They're more likely to form trusting relationships.
These are very positive generalizations about women. Do you feel any discomfort about making generalizations?
No, I don't. I wanted a woman president in my lifetime. I'm not sure that that's going to happen, but I'm very hopeful that we will have another woman mayor in my lifetime.
Okay, that's Jan Drago, who ran for mayor. And she's talking about women being inclusive and compromising and listening and forming trusting relationships. Kathy, you were nodding your head during that.
Yeah, these are the mantra, if you will, for women who run for office. Women do have different styles. Doesn't mean that a guy doesn't have those. In fact, I can't tell you the number of really smart guys I know that have decided to lead like a woman, which is to use things like inclusiveness and leading with listening. Women who care about kind of pulling people together, asking a lot of questions. I mean, there's like these 10. Ironically, the woman's way of leading was written by a former prof at Seattle U, Bev Forbes, and she wrote the book that now worldwide sits as kind of like the big thing for how women lead versus how men lead. Doesn't mean guys aren't, and actually right now I will help any guy who leads like a woman. Many times I've been known to make men honorary women because they actually lead like women.
I hope to achieve that in the course of this conversation. I'd be very flattered.
Been watching it.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Joni Balter, what do you think? Lead like a woman?
You know, I think that's a little too precious here. What I would say is that it's true that women sometimes govern differently. I'm hearing the words of Senator Patty Murray as you're playing the clip and as Kathy is talking. This whole thing of sharing credit, which wasn't mentioned, very important. Is more often attributed to women elected officials than it is to men. I think we're very likely to have a woman mayor here this time or next time pretty soon. I think that's coming. You know, Bertha Knight Landis, we're referring to her. She is not a tunnel boring machine. She was the mayor from 1926 to 1928.
And she gave that machine, Bertha, its name.
She did.
Bob Donegan did.
And I had my own feelings about naming that after her.
What are those feelings?
Don't.
Really? Why?
I can make that pretty soon. I don't know.
Only in hindsight?
No, the whole way through. Oh. I did not really think that was the greatest idea. But okay. Do note that she only served that 1 2-year term.
That's
at
right.
That time.
And she ran for a second term.
Right. And as soon as they could, they chased her out of here. I do think that I don't think it's the voters here that have kept women from this position. I think the voters in Washington and in Seattle are very open to women in all kinds of these positions. So I don't think it was like a sexism thing. I think it has to do with sort of time and circumstance and breadth of experience at the time, the collection of people who run. I think that explains a lot of it. Because our voters, as you know, I mean, this is history. We've talked about this before. From 1993 to 2004, Washington had the highest percentage of women in the legislature. I have a picture that I looked at this morning of the Seattle City Council in 1994, 7 women and 2 men. So I don't think it's the voters. I think it's mostly, if you were looking for a reason for why we haven't had a woman mayor since Bertha, would be something to do with the fact that, you know, women self-select out. It's sort of the difference between the way men and women approach a job. Men will sometimes say, "Yeah, I have flaws, but no one will notice them. I'm so after that goal, I'm going for it." And women will focus maybe just a tad too much on their own flaws and like, you know, well, I have this the rest of my family to take care of, or people will find out I don't know X, whatever X is.
Okay, let me bounce that off of Kathy, because we're starting to get at some reasons now. Do you buy that women self-select out?
Yes, some do, but actually when Ann Cain first called me and asked me about this,
This is KUOW's producer.
Yeah, she asked me about it, and I'm saying, well, you know, we've had a bunch that have run, very competent, good women, but when I went back to actually look at all of the times when a woman was actually queuing up to run, you know, we have really here in Seattle had quite a lot of what I call clique politics. The inside clique were basically guys who came from Democratic districts, or they were people who had been on the city council and had actually moved up as like the president of the council and so on. So self-selecting is more of a generalized reason why many women self-select themselves out. But here in Seattle, when we've had good women who have resumes, in some cases, stronger than the guys that beat them, certainly Norm Rice and Dolores Sabanga. Dolores Sabanga had a resume as long as your arm. And yet when she ran, what happened when she ran for mayor, it was because, oh no, I'm sorry, it's Norm's turn. And that became part of what was the dialogue during that campaign cycle. So in some ways, it's been different. It's only been recently when, I got to tell you, for the last three terms, when it's been hard to find a woman to run. Colleagues of mine and I have been looking to find the right women or a woman to run in many cases. Actually, we've been out here at the UW. We tried to talk Kelly Testy into it from the UW Law School. We've been looking for women who have a complement of basic services. I can also tell you, for at least 10 years, we've been urging Jenny Durkin to run for mayor. This woman, in fact, I know for a fact that
folks have urged her to run for governor before.
I've heard
that, and she joked about it at one point and thought about it.
Yeah, and I think that what it is that I don't know that she even joked about it. I think that she had considered running for Congress when McDermott left, Congressman McDermott left. But the fact is, right now, it's not an inside clique without women. Right now, what you're seeing are a lot of women that are running. I was interested in knowing that the last several open seats have actually been the kind that women only were the people that we looked at. And frankly, this year, all I know is that many women since the Women's March have told me, you know what, there better be a woman running this time. Better be a woman. So where are your women? And I think we're going to get it.
Okay, so I've heard a few reasons. This is why we're here, is to answer Nick's question, why hasn't Seattle elected a woman in a century or so? I'm talking with Joni Balter and Kathy Allen. I've heard a few things. I've heard Joni said something about a breadth of experience. Are you saying that there's
breadth
not...
of experience compared to the other candidates at that time?
I
think that's how the voters have weighed it. And sometimes, you know, sometimes this is a shuffling of the deck, like we know about the upcoming primary, where you have a lot of candidates and they subtract from each other when it's a big number of candidates dividing the 100%.
Yeah. Okay. Breadth of experience. You mentioned women more likely to notice their own flaws or to focus on their own flaws.
Or just to pull themselves out. Like, I don't know if I could take the storm around whatever that is.
And that's different from finding a flaw. That's just a sort of when someone has the temperament? Are you saying that?
I mean, they're just concerned that they can't do it all, you know, with family perhaps, or that there's something they don't know and that all the other people will figure out that it's something that they don't know.
Okay. Are you buying that, Kathy?
No, I think that one thing that it does happen with women is that you have to have a hunger to do this. It has to be the most important thing you would do. Mm. And in many cases, women just won't say, look, the most important thing in my life right now is sitting on the phone asking people for money.
But we've had so many Seattle City council members and members of Congress and a governor. We've had plenty of women in office. So what's the difference?
Go back to the clique politics. It's still, and yet, when it comes to the inside groups that have determined who the early endorsed candidates would be, it's all been quite cliquish. It was either business or the chamber or whatever it was.
Your voice went down when you said business chamber.
She's trying to talk like, you know,
the business guys, the boys in the business world. Yeah. But now they're not. Now there's a lot of women in that business group. What I have found is that there's been an awful lot of folks who control the pot of who gets to run. And that group has been very late in changing.
Okay. So I also heard a man's turn. You said that it's Norm Rice's turn.
back, and this is in the late 80s. I actually talked to Dolores Sabonga. We didn't specifically talk about whether it was Norm Rice's turn, but I was asking her about how she finished fifth in a field of 13 in 1989, and she said, well, she was a city council member. She did find a double standard in politics.
When you ask tough questions as a woman, sometimes people don't like that. They think it's too aggressive. I can remember one of my critics said, I cut people off at the knees, when in fact, I think I was being very courteous. But people don't like that from women. If a man does the same thing, it's considered aggressive, showing leadership qualities.
Kathy Allen's listening going, that's true.
No, that's actually the story of my life with the asking the aggressive question. So I recognize some of that. But let's go back to 1997 and the primary at the time, and Jane Noland and Cheryl Chow and Paul Schell and Greg Nickels all ran. And it's just the way they divided the deck. So I really think this is an important thing. It depends on who all else is in the race. Jane Noland got the highest percentage, I think, one of the producers told me, of women going back 50 years. But think about it. Cheryl Chow was also in that race. So during the primary, that's the kind of thing that happened.
But are you saying voters are voting by gender? And so if there's too many women, then they're dividing up women's vote?
No, I don't think there's a women's vote. There's a lot of different votes within there.
But I think that
when you go into a primary, there's a way that the voters divide the candidates. Jane Noland did very well, but just not well enough.
But it wasn't split on gender lines. What happens in these cases is that in that year, there were a lot more reasons, I would say, starting with money, who had the most amount of money that year. Second was the ability to actually deliver a core group. As I recall, I want to say that there was an opportunity for us to make history in that race, and nobody looked at the history that would be made if we had a woman. We looked at the history if we had an African-American. But the fact is that we ended up in many of these cases, you don't just assume that women are going to vote for women because it's not true. In fact, more men end up voting for women in many elections, like, for example, judges. More women actually sit back and kind of decide who's going to run, and they, I'm not going to vote for a woman just because she's a woman. But what happens with guys is they immediately look and say, you know what, I bet she's more honest. And which is the case, one of the things that women run as is more honest. And so from that perspective, people believe that.
But why do you think that would work better on male voters than female voters?
Because I think men at that point think, well, look, if it's going to be somebody that's going to be sentencing me, I want a fair shake.
Well, we had a judge named Faith once, so that was like the way to... Just the perfect name for it.
Okay, so the men are more likely to put themselves in the convict role in that scenario, you're saying.
You'd be surprised that in many cases right now, men have been coming over in stronger numbers, voting for women, supporting women, than we have ever seen. This is a countrywide right now in terms of America. And by the way, not just America, just in the recent Britain elections, same thing happened. We had more women that actually were voting for women, which has not always been the case.
Okay. You know, former city council member Dolores Sabonga, who ran for mayor in the late 80s, she told us that basically she would ask an aggressive but courteous, she thought, question, and it would be perceived as cutting someone off at the knees, which makes me wonder about our current mayor. Ed Murray is said to have a temper, right? Acknowledge.
Oh, yeah.
Yelling at people. Do you think that Ed Murray has suffered for his alleged temper in a way that a woman might?
Well, I don't know that it would be any different, but I do think that one of the key themes of what happened with Ed Murray this spring is that the temper is known. It's known to people. So when it came time for a group of people to stand up for this mayor, male or female, he did not have a big group that was ready to say, how dare you say all of this about him? I know him. He wouldn't do this. He lacked that because the stories of having a temper on a man were well known.
In fact, I think that it's very much the case. I do agree with her on that. When you actually watch those numbers, when his numbers did not move for 3.5 weeks after the allegations and after he had all kinds of arguments actually proving in his point of view that he was innocent. The fact is that those numbers didn't move. People had at that point seen, aha, I think this emperor's got no clothes and I didn't like him to begin with. So he suffered from being there and actually amassing a lot of money and support early on. But the minute you tarnish that, it was all over.
Kathy Allen and Joni Balter are helping KUOW listener Nick Russo figure out why Seattle has not elected a woman in almost a century. Is this a Seattle thing, though? Because Tacoma has a woman serving as mayor right now. Bremerton does. Linwood, Kirkland, Mukilteo all have women as mayors.
Those women selected into the job. They have good timing, good experience, and rolled the dice.
So it's a coincidence?
No, it's a collection of factors. It's
but the Seattle
that have to coalesce.
Yeah.
So it's not like women haven't run here. They have run here. They ran against other women sometimes and guys. And so it's just the way they divided the 100% in the primary.
Well, I'm going to say that we mentioned the cliques. People who do the early anointing have a lot of power, particularly given how low the primary numbers are here. But the second thing I think is money, that women still here have been wincing at the thought of raising the amount of money that you traditionally see in a lot of the men's races. Well, in many of these cases, Seattle's races statewide, West Coast-wise, have become very professional operations, which means they're much more targeted. What happens is that you get very much into the geodemographic circles of neighborhoods and who's voting for whom. And what's happened is that I would say the degree of professionalism, which costs money, ends up actually meaning that you have a more professional outlook as opposed to somebody that's just going to actually come in and live the trend. I believe that all of these places that have had women mayors and currently have them, frankly, these are women who actually have stepped up and run professional races.
Let me ask you, I'm going to give you a one question quiz. We looked at election results going back to 1964. 147 people have run for Seattle mayor. 147. How many of them would you say were women?
7-8%.
Now you're going to make me do math. Well played.
I would think, yeah, I think it's around 10 or 12%. But I mean, I think people ran. The question is, were they the top candidates?
Well, and
this
also,
year,
yeah,
this year
Mike
you have
the Mover and all
Mike
of these
the Mover,
others.
Okay, so that's Mike the Mover can't raise money, but Mike the Mover is outsmarting all of us because we're talking about him, and it's a good
advertising
campaign.
Well, no, but except
campaign.
That for 147, if you really took a look at anyone who got like 3% or more,
that would be a better way to look at it.
Okay, fair enough. The answer, by the way, 24 people. Since 1964, 24 women on the ballot. So that's, a little less than 20%, I guess, which seems, for 1964, that seemed low to me. And this is what we're getting at, why this could be. In fact, should we get our listener on the phone and
see
if he, did we do our jobs? Nick Russo, thanks for asking the question, and thanks for listening and hopping on the phone.
Yes.
What did you learn?
I learned a lot. I thought it was a great discussion, and like I said at the beginning, I don't think it was really an answerable question in a way. But I think
thanks
I was,
a lot.
I thought it was a great discussion and brought up some issues that I hadn't thought about. I mean, I've thought about some possible reasons for that. And
what's one reason that occurred to you because of this discussion that was persuasive or you hadn't thought of before?
I think the kind of the cliques, old boys club aspect of it, mm-hmm. Just as to who would actually be a likely candidate. And the other piece was the idea of self-selection, and I think the one thing that I've been encouraged about this year is how many women are running,
right,
and have stepped forward and said, "Hey, I can do this." So I think it's opened up a lot more possibilities for our city.
That's right. Self-selection has happened. And on this ballot, we have, is it six women on the ballot, I think, this time? That's KOW listener Nick Russo who kicked off this whole discussion. Thanks for that, Nick. Thanks for your local wonder question.
Thank you.
Final words, Joni Balter, Kathy Allen, on gender and politics.
Well, one thing I think is that you could see two women come through the primary. It's very possible this year.
Yep.
And it's not just because it's a trend or anything like that. It's because there are some really solid people running.
And there's also Mike McGinn, which makes it not so solid running on some of these cases. In any event, I would say the other part that is to be seen is that nobody actually makes history in gender politics alone. You should know that we have the highest percentage of women running in all of King County's races right now that we've ever had. And, oh, by the way, the highest number of out gay folks, as well as a huge crop of women of color running. The largest campaign in the state right now is from two women of color over in that famous 45th District Senate race, where two women of color right now are in situations where there'll be millions of dollars spent in their campaign for this one position in the state Senate. So this has been hugely monumental this year, seeing what's going on, to be capped off by she, the next mayor of Seattle.
So maybe what we've been talking about is an anomaly and will be looked at as a trivia question not long. Yes, Joni?
I was just going to add one little thing here. What about those folks over at King County? There has never been a King County executive who is a woman.
There's that. Okay.
There is. In fact, there have been several who have run. So I suspect that we'll take some of the women who don't run, who didn't win mayor, and we'll just send them over there to run for county.
Kathy Allen, co-founder of the Center for Women and Democracy at the University of Washington, political consultant at her company, The Connections Group. Joni Balter is the host of Seattle Channel's Civic Cocktail. Great to talk to both of you. Thank you.
You as well.
KUOW's The Record, back in a moment. It's KUOW Seattle. Now I'd like you to meet Robert Loomis, a man who seemed to be doing pretty well, had a good job, had just signed a mortgage on a new home, and he started having chest pains, so he went to the doctor.
While I'm laying on the table, I'm 47 years old, and the doctor comes out and says, Robert, you're going to need six-way heart bypass surgery. And I said, well, I need to get my house in order. I need to do all this stuff. He goes, no, I can't let you leave the hospital. So that next morning, they operated on me, and that operation ended up costing $480,000.
The medical bills were more than Robert could manage. He went into debt. He lost his house. He moved into a hotel, and then he couldn't keep up with those payments.
And then one day, I just had no money and no rent, and all I had was my car. And the only thing I'd ever known was Ballard, really. So I just got in my car and came to Ballard and parked at 22nd and 62nd for 3 years.
Robert came in to tell me of his experience of being homeless in Seattle. This is back in March, and we talked about how he wanted the city to help, not just him, but to help other Seattle residents who don't have a stable home. And he told a story about sleeping in that car in Ballard. He woke up one morning to a man approaching him with a camera.
I could hear him talking. I could barely make out. I thought it was a parking enforcement person. But then I sat up, and the thing, he goes, oh, yeah, loser. Yes, right. Wake up, all you losers out here that don't do anything. Meanwhile, he's got a video camera and he's videotaping me. Yeah, you know what? Now with our new president, you're going to have to get off your and start working and making a difference and, you know, all this. Yeah, that's right, loser. Look at me. You know, and I'm leaving out all the cuss words and all the other stuff he called me. So, and I'd never been subjected to that in my life. I've always been Robert, the guy, the man. I went to the church and I cried on my priest's shoulder because now I'm getting teary-eyed again because it just brings back really painful memory. And that happened to me twice where neighborhood people would come by and just really make you feel like dirt.
Did you ever talk back to any of those people?
No. No. The one time I did have a conversation with the man, I just said, look, you know, he wanted me to move my car because I was parking in a different space. And I go, sir, I'm not doing anything. I'm just right here. And by law, I can be here for 72 hours. and you won't have any trouble on me on this. No, we're not going to have that.
What when they see you, Robert, what do you think they see?
Well, it's funny because I guess because they see my car. The second guy actually leaned in and looked in my car and saw all the stuff that you have when you're homeless. You can't always take your trash out. You don't have everything all neat and buttoned up sometimes. It's just, you know, the number of medications that have fallen out of my pocket in my car, you know, through sleeping or through my bag falling over, stuff like that is, you know, it wasn't the neatest place in the world. But try living in a shoebox for 3 years and it's not going to be all that pretty.
Well, why the shoebox? Why not some kind of shelter?
Well, being in a shelter, you know, one of the guys that volunteers with me who is currently homeless, he calls it kind of like being in a prison dorm. They have so many rules and regulations. You know, I went to the Bread of Life, and I was really disappointed because they used to say you can't get a place to sleep if you don't come in and listen to the chapel, where they tell you about you're going to hell and, you know, you need to get saved, and because they wouldn't even let you get to the food line until you sat there and listened to the service. Meanwhile, they have these big flat screen TVs that they show NBA games on that show commercials of Bud Light and Budweiser and Crown Royal. And I'm like, you know, a large portion of the people sitting in here, you're making them awfully thirsty if that's your goal, to be a Christian place, right? And then the shower. Oh, they had 3 shower heads and there were 60 men. And you just stand there in your skivvies and your towel and you wait your turn. And I only stayed there 3 nights. The second night I was there, I looked down and 3 of the people before me had ankle bracelets on, the kind where they want to keep track of where you are and stuff. And I've never even been to a police station in my life. So I've never even had a speeding ticket. I don't even know, you know, that was the thing that how my life changed from a vision point of view of what the world is. And I thought of myself worldly because I've done a lot of volunteer work. I've been in some rough areas, you know, all that stuff. But boy, it's just a different world.
You brought up the rules and regulations at shelters.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to bring up one of those listeners who might think they know you, right?
Right.
Yeah, you don't want to abide by rules and regulations. Guess what? Nobody likes rules and regulations.
Well, sure. But if you're trying to get a job, and say an office job like I wanted to do, you have to be out of there no later than 6:30 every morning. It's pouring down rain. Where do you go? The library's closed. You try going to sit at Starbucks. They say, get out. You're not buying anything. I mean, these are some of the things they don't take into account that, okay, this person's working, trying to get their life together. Let's work with them. Maybe he doesn't have to leave at 6:30. His office opens at 8:30. Maybe we can let him sit here till 7:30 or have a place for that. So rules and that's what I mean by rules and regulations. Not, you know, they make you make your bed every day. That doesn't bother me. I do that anyway. And plus, just the population that you're enclosed with. It's not like having a roommate. You don't get to choose the person sleeping next to you. You just get to deal with whoever is around you and they yell, scream, cuss, fight, do whatever, you know. So that's the other part of why I couldn't do it. So I just said, I'd rather go live in my car.
Robert, you got a federal housing voucher.
I did.
Now you've got an apartment.
Yes.
In a local nonprofit.
Uh-huh, Shag.
Shag. What's life like for you now?
Oh, it's the word I use to tell people is it's lovely. You know, the funny part is that when I first got it, I had to retrain myself. And I don't, you know, that's another thing I'd like to see the city get ready for is people when they move from, you know, you jump them into an apartment and they've been homeless for 10, 5, 3 years, things are different for you. I mean, when I first got there, I would forget that I had moved into my apartment when I went to sleep at night. And in my car, the one thing you hated was if you had to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night, you would just hold it as long as you could. And it took me, I don't know, a week or so to remind myself when I woke up in the night having to go to the bathroom, dude, it's right next door, you know, things like that. You can actually cook a meal, you know, reshopping again. The big shock came for me last month because I had budgeted out everything didn't even think that I'd have an electric bill because I haven't paid one in 3 years, you know? Sure. So some of that, I think, support and training for people, that especially if they've been really chronically homeless.
What could, we talk so much about what the city and county are doing and mm-hmm. should do for homeless people. From your point of view, what could your city and county do for you that would help the most?
Well, I was about to say spend the money more wisely, but
why more wisely?
Well, I just think that, you know, I know for a fact that they sent a couple of the city council to Boston to study homelessness. And we all laughed at that. All the homeless people laughed at that. They're like, why don't they just walk over here, come and sit in the kitchen and find out? But
we'll save you a plane ticket.
Yes, exactly. But, you know, it's the age-old thing. It's we don't have enough mental health centers. We don't have enough drug addiction centers, alcohol centers. I just think you have to have more those services. But then people, you know, I know even one of the ladies in the kitchen said to me, you know, she has a little problem with the mayor throwing out, I'm going to spend $55 million on the housing situation. And she says, my taxes are already too high. You know, that's why the first thing out of my mouth to you when you said what should be done, I said the money needs to be spent more wisely. You know, I don't know. I don't pretend to have all the answers. I just know that for me, the hardest part was trying to keep up hope. There were times I wanted to kill myself, literally, because I just didn't want to be known like this, and I didn't want to be, it's not what I dreamed of in my life. You know, I always wanted to be successful and prove to people that I was worth something, you know, and so that's what kept me going.
You know, Robert, that man who videotaped you and called you a loser, what does he not understand about you?
Well, you know, I always heard when I was growing up, you pick yourself up by your bootstraps. And what I say to people like him is, I go, well, what do you do if you reach down there and there's no strings left? There's no laces. Your heart, that's one lace gone. I have medical issues. You reach down, debt, that's another lace gone. Can't work, there's another lace gone. You know, there are laces. How can you pull yourself up by your boot laces if you don't have any laces, if all your laces are taken away? That's what I would say to him.
When you hear Seattleites complain about homeless people's tents, car camping, garbage, needles, criminal activity, mm-hmm. what do you think?
I think it's real. I think it is. And but I think that, you know, when people talk about that stuff, they have to realize that as a society, we have failed. And so this is what we are getting back in return.
Robert Loomis lived in his car in Ballard for 3 years, and he told you there what's helped him move into housing, what could help us all live together a little better. What is your story? We'd like to know. Tell us your story at record@kuow.org. That's our email address, record@kuow.org. KUOW Seattle, I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter @KUOW. The deadline is Saturday for people who own an empty second home in Vancouver, BC. The city says vacant homes are a problem because housing's already expensive and a vacant home is one less available home, and that just pushed prices up. So this Saturday's the deadline. You've got to either rent out that home or sell it or live in it or pay a tax. It's Canada's first ever vacancy tax, so let's see how it's working out so far. Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Bill.
Why are so many people keeping empty homes in Vancouver?
Well, I think because they're a terrific investment. Mm-hmm. I think that's why people were buying a second place and sitting on it anyway, because of the value in real estate in British Columbia.
Right.
We've seen a bunch of attempts over the last year to kind of free up the housing market, make more housing available for the people that live in the city and that want to live and work there. The provincial government brought in a tax to discourage foreign buyers, and the city brought in this vacancy tax. The results, fairly, mixed so far. In Vancouver, they're saying that people are adopting various dodges to get around the vacancy tax. They're sort of subletting the property to their relatives, or they are, some of them, renting them out, but not many of them are doing what the city hoped would happen, Bill, which is to dump the properties back on the market and have them sold and be available to somebody else.
What did the city get wrong?
Oh, I think it's just the housing market in British Columbia. The demand is real and the supply is small. The one encouraging set of numbers we got today, and we got this from the provincial government, they were just released this morning, is there has been a massive jump in housing starts in British Columbia. So normally a good year for us has been 25,000 units. We're well over 40,000, so not quite doubled, but a big jump. And with more and more units coming on, you're getting the supply side of the equation dealt with. In the long run, that may mean, at least more property available. A lot of it is what you'd call multi-residential, so companies that are building condominiums, apartments, townhouses. The government's also spending about $1 billion building kinds of social housing. So in the long run, it may take care of it. I think the city of Vancouver will give the vacancy tax a try for a while. I don't think they'll write it off right away, but the early indications are that people are finding ways around it, I think is the honest thing to say so far.
Right. How popular or unpopular is the tax?
I guess if you're sitting out there waiting for housing, it's probably pretty popular. If you're trying to figure out a way to dodge it, it's not so popular.
Uh-huh.
There's also, one of the interesting things to me is how it's going to work out. They did sort of install a snitch line, too. So if you think your neighbor has been leaving his condominium vacant, you can kind of turn them into the city, and the inspectors will go and check on them. We'll see how that works out. Needless to say, that was kind of controversial as well.
So some people say, no, it's not empty. It's being, my kids are using it, or my friends.
Yeah, that's right, or my brother, or my cousin, one of the things, like, how do you figure out if a property's really vacant? Well, one of the things that led them to think there were a lot of them was they checked the records for electricity usage, right? Mm-hmm. If a property, if the lights weren't really ever on, but then, you know, what people were doing was they were putting in little automated light switch on, the kind of things that people hook up when they go on vacation.
Right.
Or they were having a caretaker drop by and sort of run the TV and the stereo system and the dryer. I mean, really? Is the government going to be able to stop all this? I think they may be able to crack down on it, but I'm not sure they're ever going to be able to stop it.
We got to go. Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer, thanks for telling us about it.
Bye-bye, Bill.
On KUOW's The Record.